All right. Well, thank you all for coming, and we are going to begin our four Sunday school at approximately 10 o'clock on Sunday, August the 4th, 2013. And we are continuing with our study of Plutarch's Lives, and I have an image of Plutarch, who was born in 45 A.D. and lived until 120 A.D. He was born in Chaerone in Boeotia, which is northwest of Athens of ancient Greece. He was born into a wealthy family and a distinguished family. He studied rhetoric and philosophy at Athens. During his career, he became one of the priests of Temple of Apollo in Delphi. He went to Rome for a period of time, and while he was in Rome, he did not learn the native language, which was Latin. Instead, he spent a lot of time lecturing and teaching other people. He went at a later point in his life to Rome. He was famous throughout the Roman Empire, and at some point, the Emperor Hadrian, who reigned from 117 to 138, actually gave royal honors to Plutarch. And we can see that from the dates, because Plutarch died in 120, that Hadrian had only been the emperor for about 3 years before the honors from the Emperor Hadrian came. One of the greatest works of Plutarch was the Parallel Lives, which is what we are studying today. Parallel Lives is 46 separate lives of one Greek and one Roman, which he did in parallel during the prime of his, during the greater part of his powers, which was in the last 20 years of his life. In the last 20 years of his life, Rome was the undisputed power of the world. It was relatively free. It was very prosperous, and so he lived in the best of times. The Parallel Lives was referred to by Ralph Waldo Emerson as a Bible for heroes, and so I am delighted to be reading it and to be talking with you about it. During the 16th through the 18th centuries, this particular work had a very strong influence on European literature. For example, one of the lives which we have already done, which was Coriolanus, was turned into a play by Shakespeare. And the Shakespeare has other plays. For example, I think doesn't he have a play called Caesar? What's the play called? Julius Caesar is also based on Plutarch's Lives. Now, we have not and are not going to do all 46 lives. We have done about eight so far. We are doing the ninth today, and we are going to finish the year up, which will be a whole year of studying Plutarch, with the parallel life to this life, which is Cicero's life, and then we will do Alexander, and we will finish with a grand finale of Caesar, who I just mentioned. And so I'm looking forward to that. It has really been a great adventure for us, for me, and I hope for us. Now, what I'd like to talk about briefly is Demosthenes. He was born in 384 B.C., and he died in 322 B.C., and his dates, well, let me mention that during his life, obviously, Plato was alive, and there's some dispute about whether or not he actually was a student of Plato, but even more interesting that to me is the fact that he was alive. His dates are coextensive with the dates of Aristotle. In other words, Demosthenes was born in 384, as was Aristotle. Demosthenes dies in 322, as was Aristotle. So they were in the same place at the same time, and they were both men who we celebrate even down to today. Now, a fact that I was basically completely unaware of before I did this work on Demosthenes is that he was mostly a politician. We always think about him as a great speaker, and of course he was, but the context of his speaking was the politics of Athens. And his great enemy, or his great foil during his entire lifetime, was Philip of Macedon, who was the father of Alexander the Great, and who, during this time period, was in the process of taking over all of Greece. And it was Demosthenes' mission in life to resist that takeover. This is an image of Greece during the period, and ultimately Philip was to take over all of Greece, Macedon, the yellow part there, with the exception of Sparta, and then ultimately, of course, he crossed over into Persia and went as far as India. So Alexander the Great, was the son of Philip, was quite the conqueror. So now let me talk about the actual reading that we had for today, which is the parallel life of Demosthenes. An interesting side bit is that the word Demosthenes and the word and the name of all of the great heroes that Plutarch writes about only appears once in each of these. It always appears as the first word, Demosthenes. And so this first essay, this essay about Demosthenes begins. But oddly, it doesn't begin with Demosthenes. It begins with a couple of paragraphs about Plutarch himself, and he alludes to the fact that some people say that in order to be happy, you have to come from a famous city. And to some extent, Plutarch doesn't agree with that. He said it's almost the same thing as saying in order to be happy, you have to be born of a small or plain-looking woman, as if that was some great horror. Plutarch mentions that it's true that you have to live in a great city if you are a participant in one of the arts whose end is to acquire great riches or great honors, and that a person with skills that can acquire great riches or great honors is likely to wither and decay in poor and undistinguished towns. But Plutarch says that if virtue is your strong point, then it can thrive in any place where it might find itself. And then he says, quoting, "I for my part shall desire that for any deficiency of mine in right judgment or actions, I myself may, as in fairness, be held accountable, and I shall not attribute it to any obscurity of my birthplace." And as I mentioned, he was born in Chaeronea, which is northwest of Athens, which is sort of in the middle of that big yellow piece that you see on the screen there, which was a small town. Now, he does say that in order to be well educated, that the most needful thing is to reside in some city of good note that's addicted to the liberal arts and that is populous, where the person who is going to flourish as an intellectual will have access to all sorts of books, and he may ask other people of the great populace of those things which only are held in the minds of other people. But, Plutarch says, "But for me, I live in a little town where I am willing to continue lest it should grow less." So he was very, very loyal to his Chaerone, and even after spending some time in Italy and Rome, he came back there and he lived in his little town, and he was a magistrate and he was an archon, probably more than one time for a one-year term. He actually worked on things like working with the plumbing or sewage systems and all that kind of stuff. So he was a good citizen of his town. And so now Plutarch begins his conversation about his fifth book. Apparently, Plutarch's lives were divided into a number of books, and he refers to this parallel life as occurring in the fifth book of his parallel lives. And he tells us that he is going to make a comparison between Cicero and Demosthenes in this particular work. But he warns us that he is not going to attempt to compare the speeches of Demosthenes, which are great, with the speeches of Cicero, which are also great, because he reminds us that he did not learn Latin, while he was in Rome, and therefore he could not make a fair comparison between the two speakers. And this quote is given to him. He says, and he's quoting some other person, he says, "But we are but like a fish upon dry land." In other words, he's saying, I'm a fish out of water when it comes to comparing Greek speeches with Latin speeches. He does tell us, though, that he is shocked at the similarities between Cicero and Demosthenes. He points out that both of them had a great passion for distinction, they both loved liberty and of the civil life, that they both were not courageous in war, and we will hear briefly about that with respect to Demosthenes momentarily. And he said that they had a lot of sort of incidental similarities, one of which was their birth in obscure towns. Demosthenes was born in Cirene, as we've just mentioned, and that they contested with kings and tyrants, and we'll hear something about that momentarily too. They end up having their daughters die for reasons which are tragic. Interestingly, Plutarch's daughter dies during Plutarch's life as well, at the age of two or something like that, and one of Plutarch's essays or letters is a letter to his wife in which he encourages her not to grieve too much for the loss of their dear daughter. And of course, he is very, very afflicted and tragically hurt by the death of his daughter, and he sort of works through that in this letter of Plutarch. He mentions that both Cicero and Demosthenes were driven out of their country in disgrace and ultimately welcomed back. And finally, he says that both Cicero and Demosthenes were ultimately lost their lives to tyrants, and at the same time, their people lost their freedom. So thus, Plutarch introduces us to Demosthenes. He mentions to us that his father was also named Demosthenes, and that he was a citizen, that is, Demosthenes' father was a citizen of good rank in his own town, and that he was a sword maker. One might argue that this is a significant fact given the political history which we are going to see here momentarily. His father died when he was age 7 and left him with 15 talents, which according to the secondary source I read is about $11 million. Amazing. I remember making the point some time ago, too, that a single talent was about the price of a trireme, which is a warship. So that makes some sense. $11 million, 15 talents, 15 warships. There's some matching there going on. And he was raised by guardians from age 7, but unfortunately those guardians were spendthrifts and perhaps embezzlers, because when he came of age, he did not have any money left. And so one of his first actions as a speaker was to bring a lawsuit against his guardians. And he was actually successful in that, and he won 10 talents back. But unfortunately, as always happens, or many times happens, thieves spend the money and they don't get much. So even though he got a judgment for 10 talents, he did not get much of it back, and that was very disagreeable. But he wasn't entirely pleased with his performance, and so he, as a speaker, and so he went to, he had tutors, and one of the two tutors brought him before a great speaker of the time whose name was Callistratus. Now, Callistratus was a philosopher and a politician, sort of like Demosthenes ended up being. He was a person who advocated the interests of Sparta at Athens, and he was trying to, as opposed to Athens and Sparta, Athens and Thebes, and so there was this conflict among the city-states, and Callistratus was defending himself against charges of treason. Callistratus actually ended up being condemned to death, and he was killed in 355. But Demosthenes' observations of the magnificence of Callistratus, and people would come far and wide to see him speak, especially in the defense of himself, caused him to be very, very interested in becoming a public speaker. Now, as I mentioned, he wasn't completely satisfied with his first performance, and people sent him out, and they criticized him for derided, quoting now, derided him for his strange and uncouth style, which was encumbered by long sentences and tortured with formal arguments. Now that's very interesting to someone who wants to learn to speak well, because it tells us what one perhaps ought to avoid when speaking in a public place. As a result of those criticisms, one day he was walking about around the Piraeus, which is the seaport of Athens. Piraeus appears in many ancient Greece episodes, and I'd love to actually go there, because Athens was up on the hill about 7 miles away, and ultimately they had these long walls. Athens was a walled city like most ancient cities were, and they built what were called the long walls, which were two walls around a street or passageway that went all the way down to Piraeus, which itself was walled. And that was one of the great strengths of Athens, is that it always, even though being besieged by invading armies, would be behind its walls, and they could go to and from their seaport, and so they had access, people to trade and supplies could come in from the sea because they had this great access to the Piraeus. You also imagine that the Piraeus must have been a place where, you know, there had been prostitutes, there would have been lots of strange people from all over the world, there would be bars, and it would be just a standard seaport with sailors and kind of a wild place, really. So anyway, Demosthenes is down there kicking around, he's pouting because he's been criticized for his public speaking and he doesn't know what he's going to do with his life. And this guy, Eunomus, who was a Thracian, came up to him. He was a very old man, and he had seen him speak, and he sees Demosthenes pouting. And so he puts his arm around his shoulder, and he says, "You know, your diction is very much like that of Pericles, who of course was a great, great hero of Athens. He said, you show no cowardness or meanness of spirit, neither in bearing or in your words, and that you just, you know, need to work on it and don't be slothful and negligent." So this encouraged him. Another time, an actor who followed him said this, and I'm quoting again. He says, talking about his failings, and then the actor says, "You say true, Demosthenes, but I will quickly remedy the cause of all this if you will repeat to me some passages out of Euripides and Sophocles, who were great playwrights, which then, when Demosthenes had pronounced, Cytyrus, presently taking up after him, gave the same passage in his rendering of it such a new form, by accompanying it with the proper mien and gesture, that to Demosthenes it seemed quite another thing." In other words, the actor asked Demosthenes to give a speech, or a little speech from a known play. He did. And then this satyr guy said, "Okay, that's not how you do it. This is how you do it." And thus inspired Demosthenes with the key to figuring out how to solve his problem. So, Demosthenes built a study underground, which is interesting. Plutarch says that the underground study in Athens still exists to this day, which would have been, you know, 120 BC or so, 120 AD at the time of Plutarch, a very interesting factoid. And so Demosthenes would go down every single day to his place. Let me see if I've got a picture of that. And he would practice. Now, we've heard the famous story about Demosthenes gave speeches with pebbles in his mouth. This was another one of his tricks to try to get around his speech impediment, by putting pebbles in his mouth and then trying to enunciate around those pebbles, speaking as clearly as he possibly could. And he also would go to the seashore, and this is a picture of that, and give speeches so that he could practice speaking over loud sounds, which I presume would be the wind and the waves. And so he's practicing by going down to the seashore. So he's very, very much dedicated to this concept. And he did this for about 10 years, and among the things he did is he would write speeches for people when they would go to court, because that's what these guys did. He acted somewhat of a lawyer in that he would go and give speeches on people's behalf. And his life in the assembly was quite vivid, apparently. One of the final criticisms of his speaking technique was that he did not do well extemporaneously. Now, that's interesting because most of us, I think, in this group tend to write our speeches out and then deliver them. My guess is that you didn't write them out and deliver them from the paper, as I do, but in the assembly in Athens, but that you practiced in your basement time and time again until you got it right and then delivered it, not extemporaneously, but basically from memory. But he did have sort of a mixture of reading from a script and extemporaneous, that was all fine. He also practiced in front of a mirror to see what he looked like in doing that. And so he became a great speaker, arguably, they say, one of the greatest of ancient Greece. That's a lovely statue of Demosthenes, isn't it? All right, so his speeches are divided into three categories. One is a political category in which he's trying to advocate some future action. Another category is judicial, where you're talking about something that happened in the past and you're trying to persuade people to make a judgment about the thing which happened in the past. And another category of speech, there's three categories here, was the category of doing some type of praise, which would be a funeral oration or some thing that was involved in ceremony. Now, as I mentioned to you, his great enemy was Philip II, and he spent most of his political career struggling with that. And the orations relating to Philip were called the Philippics. And his first oration of this type was in 354, and if his dates were 122, whatever. I don't know how old he would have been. Let's see if I got that. Go back one picture here and get his date. 384 to 354, so he'd been 30, right? And I want to read 4 minutes of that speech to you, because I've only thought of him as an orator, not a politician, but all of these speeches are related to lawyering or related to politics. So this is just a 4 minute extract from his first speech against Philip of Macedon. So he's standing before 500 people in the assembly at Athens, and he said, "If the question before us were a new one, men of Athens, I should have waited until most of the regular speakers had delivered their opinions, and if satisfied with any of their proposal, I should have remained silent. But if not satisfied, I should then have tried to express my own views. Since, however, it is our fortune to be still debating a point on which they have often spoken before, I can safely claim your indulgence if I am the first to rise and address you. For if in the past their advice had been sound, there would be no need for deliberation today." So you see in this first paragraph, there's slamming of his opponents, saying, "Look, we've heard from them before. It's led us nowhere. It's no good. So listen to me, because I'm belittling my opponents." Second paragraph. "Now, in the first place, Athenians, there is no need to despair of our present position, however hopeless it may seem. For that which is worst in the days that are past and are gone is just what affords the best assurance for the future. And what is that? It is that your affairs are in this evil plight just because of you, men of Athens, utterly fail to do your duty. Since surely you were so placed in spite of effort on your part, it would be hopeless to look for improvement." And so he's challenging in a very strong way those 500 people in the audience, and surprisingly they didn't carry him out and hang him on the spot. Next paragraph. "In the next place, bear this in mind. Some of you have been told, others know and remember, how formidable the Spartans were not many years ago, and yet how, at the call of honor and duty, you played a part not unworthy of your country and entered the lists against them in defense of your rights. I remind you of this, Athenians, because I want you to know and realize that, as no danger can assail you while you are on your guard, so if you are remiss, no success can attend you. Learn a lesson from the former strength of the Lacedaemonians, the Spartans, which you mastered by strict attention to your affairs, and the present arrogance of our enemies, which decomposes us because we ignore every call of duty. And so he says, remember those Spartans. They were really big guys too, and we defeated them. Next paragraph. But if anyone here, Athenians, is inclined to think of Philip of Macedon too formidable, having regard to the extent of his existing resources and to our loss of all our strongholds, other cities are falling about, he is indeed right. Yes, he must reflect that we too, men of Athens, once held Pydnia, Potnia, and Methone, and had in our own hands all the surrounding territory, and that many of the native tribes now in his service were then free and independent, and were indeed more inclined to side with us than with Philip. In other words, Philip used to be in the same position we are now. He had all these towns and the people, and I mean, the Athenians had those, and now he had them, but that didn't stop him. If, therefore, Philip had then come to the conclusion that it was a difficult task to fight the Athenians while they held such strong outposts in his own territory, and he was destitute of allies, in that case he would never have gained his present successes, never acquired his present power. But men of Athens, Philip saw clearly that all these outposts were but open prizes of war, that by natural right the property of the absent belongs to those who are on the spot, and property of the careless to those who can face toil and danger. It was by precisely acting on this principle that he, Philip, has mastered and now holds them all. Some he has seized by right of arms, others he has won by alliance and friendship, for indeed alliance and respect are willingly offered by all men to those whom they see ready and prompt to take action. And this is the final paragraph. So he just said, we used to have Philip's strength, but we could have it again. And you too, men of Athens, if you are willing to adopt this principle, now, if never before, if each citizen is ready to throw off his diffidence and serve the state as he ought and he best may, the rich man paying, the strong man fighting, if, briefly and plainly, you will consent to become your own masters, and if each man will cease to expect that while he does nothing himself, his neighbor will do everything for him, then, God willing, you will recover your own, you'll restore what has been frittered away, and you will turn the tables on Philip. So, he says, get off your butts, you know, pay for war and or get ready to fight a war. Now, I found that to be, that was an interesting speech to me because it showed, it was pithy, it was to the point, it was short, right? And we get the point very quickly. The speech is not very long. I didn't read the whole thing because we don't have enough time, but, you know, it's only a couple of pages. And so it's striking to me that is so pithy. One of the places that Eboe is, northeast of Athens, is an entire island that was occupied by Philip. And one of the episodes, Demosthenes says, we've got to get that place. This is another picture of it. Athens is the lower left-hand corner in the middle of that great body of land. Okay, this is what I wanted to show you. This is a picture of the Loeb Classic Library books. And I love the fact that now we have a real man, you know, last time, an existing man, not a real man. Last time we were talking about Romulus, who is probably totally fictional. But now we have somebody so real that we have many, many, many of his existing speeches, his existing letters. They still exist. And in the Loeb Classic Library, we see the Greek, and then also we see the English translation. And we can read his speeches like we just did. And I find that refreshing. Now we're past, you know, imaginings. We're talking about a real man who lived at the same time and coextensive exactly with the dates of Aristotle, for instance. All right. So, One of the, as I said, his great nemesis was Philip, and he was constantly, like I just read, urging the Athenians to fight back. And one of the things he said is, we've got to push them out of Eboea, just like I mentioned. He tried to get them to form leagues with other city-states in the Greek peninsula, even though they were our enemies in the past. We've got to form a league. We've got to fight them. And they do. Unfortunately, they don't have great success. In the Battle of Chaeronea, which is his hometown, Plutarch's hometown, interestingly enough, apparently a great battle of this period, Philip has a great success. Philip defeats everyone, and it's a great tragedy. Demosthenes even suggests that, because there's a prophecy about it, that Philip has gotten to the priests of Apollo and bribed them to suggest that things are not going to go well for him at the battle. So Demosthenes used every technique, including saying that the gods were both the spokespersons for the body were being bribed. One of the things that Plutarch tells us, and he warned us in the beginning about this, was that Demosthenes was not a great warrior, and so this is what Plutarch says. Let's see. Thus far, therefore, Demosthenes acquitted himself like a brave man, basically in his efforts to rouse the populace. But in the fight he did nothing honorable, nor was his performance answerable to his speeches, for he fled, deserting his place disgracefully and throwing away his arms, not ashamed, as Pythia observed, to belie the inscription written on his shield in letters of gold, with good fortune. So they lose the battle, and Philip takes over the entire peninsula. But Philip doesn't survive very long his victory, and he is assassinated, arguably, by his own son about 2 years after the Battle of Chaeronea. So, I failed to mention that before Philip died, he got drunk, and he was going around looking at all the dead bodies. And one of the things that he said was, he chanted something like, on the motion of Demosthenes' son, in other words, when he's walking around the dead bodies, he's talking about Demosthenes. And what this suggests is that, or screams loudly, is that Philip was very much aware of who his enemy was. It was Demosthenes. And when he was walking around the battlefield, looking at all the dead men, drunk and thinking and musing about it, he specifically, you know, mocks Demosthenes in his activities. As a result of this defeat, Demosthenes was not a friend of Athens. Well, he was charged with a crime, and there was a trial, and he was acquitted of that particular trial. And in fact, he was invited, even though he had been charged and acquitted, with giving the funeral oration for all the dead people. As I mentioned, Philip then died. But before Philip died, Demosthenes got notice of it prior to everybody else. And so he went into the assembly, and he was all dressed up really fancily, and he was optimistic. And then while he was there, they came in with the news, and he seemed prophetic because he had an advance warning of the death. But at that time, when Demosthenes went into the assembly to celebrate the death of Philip, his daughter had been dead only 7 days. And he was highly criticized. Demosthenes was highly criticized for, you know, celebrating the death of Philip, even with his dead daughter only dead 7 days. And it's interesting because several pages of this text is Plutarch defending Demosthenes' decision to go and celebrate the death of Philip, even though his own daughter had just died 7 days ago. So, with Philip dead, Demosthenes goes back to his task of rousing the populace to defend against or strike out against the Macedonians, specifically Alexander the Great now. It turns out that during this period, there was a deserter whose name was Harpalus, who came to Athens, and he brought, I think, 20 talents or some large amount of money. Obviously, 20 talents would be close to what did we say, 11 talents was, or 15 talents was 11 million, so this is close to $15 million. And this little episode about Demosthenes is not the best. This trader from Alexander's group is trying to get, you know, he's trying to get, what do you call it, asylum in Athens. And so Demosthenes would be an important factor in that because he's one of the great speakers and all this kind of stuff. And so it happens that Demosthenes sees a great Persian cup, which is part of the wealth of Harpulus, and he admires it, and he says, boy, this really feels heavy. It's got a lot of gold in it. And so Harpulus gets the idea that Demosthenes can be bought. And so he gives him 20 talents, which is an enormous sum of money. And the next day, when they're going to have this argument about whether Harpulus is going to be allowed into the city of Athens and given refuge, it is said, Plutarch tells us, the next day Plutarch came into the assembly with his neck swathed about in wool and rollers. And when they called him to rise up and speak, he made signs as if he had lost his voice. I can't talk. And so they all suspected him of taking a big bribe. And he was actually charged with that, and then this time he was convicted, and he got a 50-talent fine, which is big, right? Big bid. If 11 talents is 11 million, and if 15 talents is 11 million, 50 talents has got to be something. Well, do the math. A lot. And he gets sentenced to prison. So he actually goes to prison. But fortunately, he's able to escape, and he goes. This is Aegina, and this is about 31 miles south of the Piraeus. It's due north of there is the Piraeus and Athens in that picture, and he spends 10 years in exile on these two little islands, Trozen and the other one, Aegina, where people come and see him, and he gives lectures and he teaches and all this kind of stuff. But he's out of prison, and he's avoided the problem. And during this time, obviously, Alexander is busy taking over the world. But Alexander, as we all know, had a very short life, and he died in 323 B.C. And so they decide to call Demosthenes back to town because they love him, really. And they send a ship to Aegina to pick him up. And when he returns, the assembly remits the prison sentence. But because of the way the law is written, they cannot remit the fine. And so what they decide to do is give him a job for which they're going to pay him 50 talents. And they take the money for the job and apply it to the fine. And therefore, he's let to go free. But the Macedonians are not to be overcome. And the operator or the boss of this part of the Persian Empire, the Alexandrian Empire, is a guy named Antipater, and he sends agents to go out and capture and kill all the prominent Athenians who have been against him. And in this text, they describe the gruesome deaths that some of these people had. And what ultimately happens is that they corner Demosthenes in a temple, and in that temple he is caught, and he says, let me have one last request before you take me off. Let me write a few words to my wife on a scroll. And so he takes his pen, he bites the pen in which he has some poison, cyanide, he takes the cyanide pill, and when he's dying, he's speaking to the guy who is capturing him, who actually was in his previous life an actor, and so he'd been aware of these references. He says, "Now," he said to his captor, "as soon as you please, you may commence the part of Creon in the tragedy and cast out this body of mine unburied. What he's referring to is Antigone, which is one of the great Greek plays or great Greek stories, where Creon says, those two guys out there, you're not going to bury them. But Antigone says, she's going to bury her two brothers. And so it's a great story. And that's with that to which he is referring. Demosthenes is buried with great honors, and he has this inscription written on his gravestone: "Had you for Greece been strong, as wise you were, the Macedonian had not conquered her." In other words, he's saying, had you been strong as well as wise, then perhaps we wouldn't have been defeated. But they recognize his wisdom in the end, and that is that. Demosthenes comes down to us as one of the great orators of the ancient world, if not the greatest. Some people claim he is the greatest. That cannot be demonstrated in what I've just done, obviously. It can only be demonstrated by reading the speeches, which I haven't done. I read part of one. I do think that that would be a worthy task. What a handsome man. Any questions before we adjourn? All right, thank you all for coming. We do have a box back there to help us defray the costs of coffee, so if you have some pocket change, we would love to have you drop it in it. We will now take a 19-minute break, and we will begin the big show at 11 o'clock. Thank you very much.